What Happened to Me, Part 4 by Randall Niles. For all the materials, sources, and footnotes, go to allaboutthejourney.org. Okay, that research helped me dramatically with the historical veracity of the Old Testament, but what about the New Testament? The Old Testament was maintained as the historical archives for an entire nation by a well-organized system of recorders and scribes. However, wasn't the New Testament merely a collection of religious books and letters written by a few independent zealots trying to encourage followers after the death of their religious leader? I mean, at this point, I was on fire for exploring this stuff. Nobody ever told me this material was available. I thought the Bible was a collection of moral mythology stories used to support blind faith in a couple of major world religions. I had no idea that the Bible was grounded in historical, geographical, and archaeological evidence. And as I turned to the evidence for the New Testament writings, I was reading and digesting up to 4 books a week at this point. Well, guess what? It was remarkable again. Like the Old Testament, I found that the historical record of the New Testament was upheld again and again. The foundations of the Jewish temple, mount built by Herod the Great, they still stand in Jerusalem. The southern steps where Jesus and his followers entered the temple are preserved as an active excavation site there. The Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem is generally considered a credible site for the birthplace of Jesus. The huge Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem is also considered a reliable historical site, covering the locations of both the crucifixion and the burial of Christ. These sites were covered over and thus preserved by the Romans in the 2nd century AD and are only recently being recovered in certain areas. On the Sea of Galilee, towns such as Nazareth are still active. Capernaum and Chorazin, 2 sites Jesus visited often, have been excavated and preserved. Sites of famous teaching such as Kersey, where the swine miracle happened, Tagba, the loaves and the fishes miracle, Mount of the Beatitudes, where the Sermon on the Mount was delivered, and Caesarea Philippi, where Peter's confession was made. They're all preserved as reliable historical sites. I mean, I was spending hours at my desk with the latest archaeology books and the different periodicals, cross-referencing the latest finds with the New Testament passages. It was fascinating. The synagogue at Capernaum, where Jesus cured a man with unclean spirit and delivered the sermon on the bread of life. The house of Peter at Capernaum, where Jesus healed Peter's mother-in-law and others. Jacob's well, where Jesus spoke to the Samaritan woman. The pool of Bethsaida in Jerusalem, where Jesus healed a crippled man. The pool of Siloam in Jerusalem, where Jesus healed a blind man. The tribunal at Corinth, where Paul was tried. The theater at Ephesus, where the riot of the silversmiths occurred. Herod's palace at Caesarea, where Paul was kept under guard. It went on and on. Of course, none of this archaeological evidence proved the underlying theology to me, but it was still powerful. The places existed and the historical events happened. I wasn't convinced of the miraculous extent of these events, but there was nothing denying their historicity. I was ready to go one layer deeper and see who these history writers were. In my mind, I needed to further establish their credibility in order to start understanding where they were coming from with their record of such profound events. Well, I decided to start with Luke, because that's where the archaeologists and historians seem to start. Also, Luke wrote about 1/4 of the New Testament, with both his gospel account and the book of Acts, so for me, that was a big enough chunk of text to start testing the veracity of the entire New Testament. Well, starting about 150 years ago, scholars in Europe started rejecting the historical records of Luke. These academics declared that there was no evidence to support the existence of several locations and leaders mentioned in Luke's writings, and therefore they rejected the entirety of his account. However, I discovered that archaeological finds during the last century have revealed that Luke was a very accurate historian, and the 2 books he authored were absolutely authoritative records of history. One of the greatest archaeologists of all time was Sir William Ramsay. He studied under the famous German historical schools in the mid-19th century, which taught that the New Testament was a religious treatise written in the mid-200s AD and not a historical document recorded in the first century. Ramsay was so convinced of this teaching that he entered the field of archaeology and went to Asia Minor to specifically find the physical evidence to refute Luke's biblical record. Well, after years of field study, Ramsay completely reversed his entire view of the Bible and first century history. He wrote, "Luke is a historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements of fact trustworthy, He is possessed of the true historic sense. In short, this author should be placed along with the greatest of historians. Luke's accuracy is demonstrated by the fact that he names key historical figures in the correct time sequence. He also uses the correct and often obscure government titles in various geographical areas, including the politarchs of Thessalonica, the temple wardens of Ephesus, the proconsul of Cyprus, and the, quote, first man of the island in Malta. In Luke's announcement of Jesus' public ministry, he mentions Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene. And scholars questioned Luke's credibility, since the only Lysanias known for centuries was a leader of Chalcis, who ruled from about 40 to 36 BC. However, an inscription dated to the time of Tiberius, which is 14 to 37 AD, was just found, which records a temple dedication naming Lysanias as the tetrarch of Abila, which is Abilene near Damascus. This matched Luke's account and stunned the liberal scholarship of the day. In the book of Acts, Paul was brought before Gallio, the proconsul of Achaia. And again, archaeology confirms this account. At Delphi, an inscription from Emperor Claudius was discovered that says, Lucius Junius Gallio, my friend and the proconsul of Achaia. Historians date the inscription to 52 AD, which supports the time of Paul's visit there in about 51 AD. Later in Acts, Erastus, a co-worker of Paul, is appointed treasurer of Corinth. And in 1928, archaeologists excavated a Corinthian theater and discovered an inscription that reads, Erastus, in return for his idolship, laid the pavement at his own expense. The pavement was laid in 50 AD, and the term adile refers to the designation of treasurer. In another passage, Luke gives Publius, the chief man on the island of Malta, the title First Man of the Island. Scholars questioned this strange title and deemed it unhistorical. Well, inscriptions have recently been discovered on the island that indeed give Publius the title of, quote, First Man. Elsewhere, Luke uses the Greek term politarchs, rulers of the city, to refer to the leaders in Thessalonica. Although it sounds inconsequential, this was another hit against Luke's credibility for centuries, because no other Greek literature used this term. However, approximately 20 inscriptions have now been discovered that bear the term politarch, including 5 finds that specifically refer to the ancient leadership in Thessalonica. As a final example, Luke calls Iconium a city in Phrygia. Who cares? Well, this was also a major rub against the credibility of Luke for centuries. Scholars going all the way back to writings from historians like Cicero maintained that Iconium was in Lyconia, not Phrygia. Therefore, scholars declare that the entire book of Acts was unreliable. Well, guess what? In 1910, Ramsay himself was looking for evidence to support this long-held claim against Luke, and he uncovered a stone monument declaring that Iconium was indeed a city of Phrygia. And many archaeological discoveries since 1910 have confirmed this. Luke was right. A famous historian, A.N. Sherwin White, declares, in all, Luke names 32 countries, 54 cities, and 9 islands without error. For Acts, the confirmation of historicity is overwhelming. Any attempts to reject its basic historicity must now appear absurd. I'll end with this one. Luke's opening to the Christmas story that many of us are familiar with. And it came to pass in those days that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This census first took place while Quirinius was governing Syria. So all went to be registered, everyone to his own city. Well, in this passage, we learn of a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world will be taxed and everyone must return to their home city for a formal census. We also read that this concept of registration and taxation was first decreed when Quirinius, it's also known as Cyrenius, was governing Syria. Well, for centuries, this whole text was considered a fabrication, since there was no secular record of such a Roman census and that people had to return to their home cities. Also, the only record of Quirinius, or Cyrenius, being governor of Syria was 6 to 7 AD by Josephus. Much too late to coincide with the biblical record. Well, guess what? Recent discoveries reveal that the Romans did have a regular enrollment of taxpayers and held a formal census every 14 years, beginning with the reign of Caesar Augustus. In addition, an inscription and other archaeological evidence reveal that Quirinius was indeed governing Syria around 7 BC. Although not with the official title of governor, he was the military leader in the territory at the time. Finally, a papyrus discovered in Egypt generally discusses the system of Roman taxation, declaring the following, quote, "Because of the approaching census, it is necessary that all those residing for any cause away from their home should at once prepare to return to their own governments in order that they may complete the family registration of the enrollment," end quote. Now, I had to admit, Luke passed my notion of a credibility test. In fact, his style was far from the religious fanaticism that I expected. Like me, his whole point for writing his accounts was to collect the evidence and present the historical case for Jesus and his teachings. For me, it was powerful that Luke writes his entire text as a research paper, an orderly account for a Roman official named Theophilus. Here's the beginning of Luke's record. Quote, "Having carefully investigated all of these accounts from the beginning, I have decided to write a careful summary for you to reassure you of the truth of all you were taught," end quote. So as an authoritative writer of history, Luke passed my test with flying colors. I wasn't ready to accept his theology, but I wasn't really testing that yet. I was still checking out the authenticity and credibility of these guys. So who is next on the list? Well, John also wrote a big chunk of the New Testament, including his Gospel, letters, and the Book of Revelation, so that's where I went next. Again, I wasn't focusing on the theological stuff yet. I just wanted to test the historical elements first. Well, I soon discovered that John's accuracy is also supported by recent discoveries. In the Gospel of John, Jesus heals a man at the pool of Bethsaida, and John describes the pool as having 5 porticos. Until recently, this site was a point of scholarly skepticism. Then, 40 feet underground, archaeologists discovered a pool with 5 porticos in a surrounding area that perfectly matches John's description. Later in the text, John describes the Pool of Siloam, another site of contention for hundreds of years. Well, archaeologists discovered this pool in 1897. Further in John's Gospel, John describes Pontius Pilate speaking to Jesus from the judgment seat in a place called the pavement, Gabbatha in Hebrew. For hundreds of years, scholars used this myth to reject John's record of Jesus and the trial by Pilate because there was no historical record of a court called Gabbatha or the pavement in Jerusalem. However, famous archaeologist William Albright revealed that this place was, in fact, the court of the Tower of Antonia, which was destroyed by the Romans in 66 to 70 AD. It was left buried when Jerusalem was rebuilt in the time of Hadrian, but it was recently uncovered during excavations there. Okay, that's great stuff for site support, but what about some of these larger-than-life characters such as Pontius Pilate, the governor of Rome who presided over the trial of Jesus? Well, in 1961, archaeologists discovered a plaque fragment in Caesarea, a Roman city along the Mediterranean coast of Israel. And this plaque was written in Latin, and it was embedded in a section of steps leading to Caesarea's amphitheater. And the inscription includes the following, "Pontius Pilate, Prefect of Judea, has dedicated to the people of Caesarea a temple in honor of Tiberius." Emperor Tiberius, he reigned from 14 to 37 AD, perfectly meshing with the New Testament account that records Pontius Pilate ruling as governor from 26 to 36 AD. Tacitus, a well-known first century Roman historian, also mentioned Pontius Pilate. Quote, "Christus, from whom the name has its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate," end quote. Wait, did I read that right? A Roman historian not only mentions a Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, but he also mentions Christ, and his suffering at the hands of Pilate? For me, this was huge. I was always taught that Jesus Christ and the events of the New Testament were solely contained in the Bible. I was blown away. Are there other ancient writings outside the Bible mentioning New Testament people and events? Even Jesus himself? I made a big old star in my notes, because I was definitely coming back to this one. Okay, now what? All of this stuff happened, historically, I mean. I still didn't accept the theological implications of these events, but they obviously happened nonetheless. They weren't myths, they weren't hoaxes, they were historical events. So how could I start testing the depths of these events? I mean, what drove the writers of the Bible to such passion? What compelled these men to write and defend such profound messages in connection with these historical events? I mean, come on. Were there really divine underpinnings to all these books? Intellectually, I now knew something metaphysical was out there. I mean, more than metaphysical, something with intelligence. But could I really accept that these books were from outsider dimensions of time and space? I was ready to accept the Bible as a very special book. I was even ready to declare its historical trustworthiness. But the notion of divine inspiration still seemed a little over the edge to me. I just couldn't get my skeptical mind around that one. If God truly delivered this book from outside our four dimensions, wouldn't he just tell us? I understand that the writers of the Bible say it's divinely inspired, but that's just not enough for me. It just seems that if God truly delivered this book to mankind through a group of 40 or so authors, that he would give us something to hang our hats on. Yes, I'm stunned by the Bible's historical veracity and the archaeological support and the internal integrity of it all. The evidence is fantastic and definitely sets the Bible apart. But how could I ever be asked to jump the chasm from really special book to divinely inspired letter from God? Well, I discovered that the Bible took care of this. I found that the Bible itself declares the test for divine inspiration. The test is established as 100% fulfilled prophecy. In all candor, when I read this, I kind of laughed. Yeah, right. This is the test of the tabloid press, too. Whenever a major world event happens, people love the hyper-prophecy in urban legend. The tabloids, they love to showcase the ancient and not-so-ancient prophecies of Nostradamus, Gene Dixon, Edgar Cayce, the Bible. Why was the Bible lumped together with all that goofiness? These so-called prophets get one thing right and the public could care less about all their other predictive failures. What a game. Well, wait, the Bible declares that its test for supernatural inspiration is 100% fulfilled prophecy. That means no predictive failures whatsoever. Wow, that's really remarkable. 100%, no misses. I really had to absorb that. I mean, would the multi-billion dollar gambling and lottery industries exist today if people could legitimately and consistently tell the future? Of course not. Maybe this prophecy thing wasn't as laughable as I first thought. Okay, I guess the power in the Bible's 100% fulfillment standard is directly proportional to the number of prophecies declared in the Bible. Obviously, 100% of two isn't that staggering. So I decided to carefully and honestly study the prophetic scriptures. With the help of some study aids, I discovered over 1,000 prophecies in the Bible. And of those, an astonishing 668 of them have been fulfilled. None have ever been proven false. I found 3 that seem to be unconfirmed by secular sources, but none have been proven false. The others focus on events that are supposed to take place in the future. Come on, these must be generalized, self-fulfilling predictions that find their fulfillment within the pages of the same book. I mean, one religious zealot writes a prediction that God will do something specific and dramatic, and another writes the fulfillment that God did something specific and dramatic, and the predictions and fulfillments are confined to the pages of the same holy book. It's not too meaningful. Where's the outside support? What does secular history say, if anything, about these events? I decided to take a hard, calculated look at some of the Bible's historical prophecies. The decree of Cyrus. In about 700 BC, Isaiah named Cyrus as the king who will allow the Israelites to return to Jerusalem and rebuild its temple. At the time of this prophecy, there was no king named Cyrus, and the temple in Jerusalem was totally built and in full operation. Well, in 586 BC, more than 100 years later, the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar sacks Jerusalem and destroys the temple. The Jews living in Jerusalem were either killed or taken captive to Babylon. In about 539 BC, the Babylonian Empire was conquered by the Persians. And shortly thereafter, a Persian king named Cyrus issued a formal decree that the Jews could return to Jerusalem and rebuild their temple. This decree is confirmed by secular archaeology in the form of a stone cylinder that details many events of Cyrus's reign, including the decree to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. Remarkably, Isaiah predicted that a man named Cyrus, who would not be born for about 100 years, would give a decree to rebuild a city and a temple, which were still standing and fully active at the time. I had to check more of these out. The city of Tyre. In 586 BC, confirmed by secular sources as the 11th year of the reign of King Zedekiah of Judah, Ezekiel predicts the fall of mainland Tyre to the Babylonian armies of Nebuchadnezzar. The text further describes the siege against the island fortress of Tyre. It's a half mile off the coast of mainland Tyre, hundreds of years later. Ezekiel's prophecy describes how the future invaders would tear down the ruins of mainland Tyre and throw them into the sea. They would scrape her dust from her and leave her as the top of a rock. They will lay your stones, your timber, and your soil in the midst of the water. I will make you like the top of a rock. You shall be a place for spreading nets. Well, secular history records that Nebuchadnezzar laid siege to the great mainland city of Tyre about a year after Ezekiel's prophecy. The Encyclopedia Britannica says, after a 13-year siege from 585 to 573 BC by Nebuchadnezzar II, Tyre made terms and acknowledged Babylonian rule. When Nebuchadnezzar broke through the city gates, he found it nearly empty. Most of the people had moved by ship to an island about a half mile off the coast and fortified a city there. The mainland city was destroyed in 573 BC, which was Ezekiel's first prediction. But the city of Tyre on the island remained a powerful city for several hundred years. Secular history next records that Alexander the Great laid siege to the island fortress of Tyre in 332 BC. His army destroyed the remains of mainland Tyre and threw them into the Mediterranean Sea. As Alexander's army constructed a causeway to the island, they scraped even the dust from the mainland city, leaving only bare rock. Historian Philip Myers, in his history textbook, General History for Colleges and High Schools, writes, Alexander the Great reduced Tyre to ruins in 332 BC. Tyre recovered in a measure from this blow, but never regained the place she had previously held in the world. The larger part of the site of the once great city is now as bare as the top of a rock, a place where the fishermen that still frequent the spot spread their nets to dry. Wow, this was dramatic stuff. I mean, I had no idea. The city of Samaria. The prophets Hosea and Micah each predicted the destruction of Samaria, the capital city of the northern kingdom of Israel. Not only did these prophets predict violence and destruction, but they declared that the great city would become as a heap in the field, with its stones poured down into the valley and vineyards planted in place of its great walls, with even the foundations being removed. History tells us that Sargon took Samaria by the sword in 722 BC. Later, Alexander took the city violently in 331 BC, as did Hyrcanus in 120 BC. What's remarkable is not the violent demise of Samaria and its people, but rather some of the historic specifics of what then happened to that once great city. Reactions upon visiting the ancient spot have been recorded for centuries. In 1697, Henry Mondrell declared, "This great city is now wholly converted into gardens, and all the tokens that remain to testify that there has ever been such a place are only on the north side." Floyd Hamilton continues, "Today the top of the hill where Samaria stood is a cultivated field, with the foundations of the columns marking the place where the palaces and mansions stood. At the foot of the hill in the valley lie the foundation stones of the city." Finally, from Vandeveld, "Her foundations discovered, her streets plowed up and covered with cornfields and olive gardens. Samaria has been destroyed, but her rubbish has been thrown down into the valley. Her foundation stones, those grayish ancient quadrangular stones of the time of Omri and Ahab, are discovered and lie scattered about on the slope of the hill." Man, I read prophecy after prophecy. I read them closely and let them sink in. I took notes and collected excerpts and articles. I was fascinated with the probabilities. In his classic book, Science Speaks, Peter Stoner reviews some of these historical prophecies of the Old Testament, including Babylon, Tyre, Samaria, Gaza, Ashkelon, Jerusalem, Palestine, Moab, Ammon, Petra, Edom, all the classic historical prophecies. And Stoner uses peer-reviewed mathematical analysis and principles of probability to conclude, quote, "No human being has ever made predictions which hold any comparison to those we have considered and had them accurately come true. The span of time between the writing of these prophecies and their fulfillment is so great that the most severe critic cannot claim that the predictions were made after the events happened," end quote. For me, these historical prophecies, they weren't a tabloid lark. They weren't a contrivance. They weren't an after-the-fact hoax. They were absolutely legitimate. And as I reviewed my notes, I was truly excited, yet somehow uneasy. Because as I studied these prophecies, I couldn't deny a recurring theme in the Old Testament. I mean, who was this predicted Messiah or Shiloh mentioned as far back as the book of Genesis? Who was this coming ruler that the prophet Micah said would be born in Bethlehem, yet pre-existed time itself? Who was this Emmanuel, literally God with us, who the prophet Isaiah declared would be born of a virgin? Who was this Redeemer that Job said would come to save him and the world from death? Who is this prophesied son that would be referred to as Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, and Prince of Peace? I mean, for me, the biblical test of prophecy, it came through. Intellectually, I had no choice but to accept the facts. The fulfilled prophecies of the Old Testament authenticate its inspiration from outside our time dimension. There's no other logical conclusion, as hard as I tried to find one. But what about all these predictions of a coming Jewish Messiah, a Savior, found throughout a number of books in the Old Testament? What was I to make of them? Did I really need to deal with those as part of my prophecy analysis? I was so uneasy with what the Old Testament was revealing to me that I went out and purchased an English version of the Hebrew Tanakh. I figured that some of these predictions had to be after-the-fact insertions by non-Jews. I decided to go right to the source and clear this up. Guess what? The same messianic predictions were there in the Jewish scriptures, plain as day. I mean, my heart was truly uneasy. I needed to slow myself down. I needed to retreat to my intellect again. So I went back to my original list of questions and issues in my notebook. Okay, prophecy aside, what about all those contradictions and inaccuracies in the Bible? If this is some kind of special book from God, how can I reconcile an imperfect Bible with a supposedly perfect source? Well, the alleged inaccuracies and errors in today's Bible translations were a major intellectual barrier for me, so I decided to dive into that argument for a while. And when I started this journey, I hadn't read much of the Bible yet. However, I still maintained a list of Bible contradictions to help substantiate why I totally rejected it. It was time for me to pull out that list again. To be fair, I knew I needed to analyze my list of alleged Bible errors according to traditional rules of logic and reason. Like many things in life, certain facts can appear contradictory, but further investigation reveals something different. The law of non-contradiction, which is the basis of all logical reasoning, maintains that something cannot be A and non-A at the same time. For instance, it can't be day and night at the same time and at the same place. Therefore, if a biblical scripture violates this law, it has been established as a contradiction. However, based on this same law, two statements can differ without being in contradiction. For example, one witness in a court case might testify that he saw two people at a crime scene, let's say Jake and Sam, while another witness may only testify to seeing Sam. These statements are not contradictory. In fact, in a court of law, these statements could be considered complementary. Well, I quickly discovered that this is the nature of many of the alleged contradictions in the Bible. For instance, in Matthew, we read that Jesus met two blind men, and in Mark and Luke, we read about Jesus meeting only one blind man. In Matthew and Mark, we read that Jesus went to pray alone three times in the Garden of Gethsemane, whereas in Luke, we read that Jesus went alone to pray on one occasion. Under legal rules of evidence and the law of non-contradiction, these aren't contradictory scriptures, and yet they made my list. Some Bible contradictions appear contradictory solely because of the intricacies of Bible translation. Analysis of the original language of the Bible, Hebrew for the Old Testament and Greek for the New Testament, can solve many apparent issues. It's no different than any other textual review of translated material. All languages, including especially Hebrew and Greek, have special limitations and nuances that cause difficulty in translation. The historical context of the translation can also cause some misunderstanding. For instance, the book of Acts has two accounts of Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus. In Acts 9:7, quote, "The men which journeyed with him stood speechless, hearing a voice but seeing no man." And in Acts 22:9, "They that were with me saw indeed the light and were afraid, but they heard not the voice of him that spake to me." This is the King James Version. At first glance, these accounts seem contradictory. One says that Paul's companions heard a voice, while the other says that no voice was heard. However, the Greek text solves the matter. The construction of the verb to hear is not the same in both accounts. In Acts 9:7, it's used with the genitive, and in Acts 22:9 with the accusative. The construction with the genitive simply expresses that something is being heard or that certain sounds reach the ear. Nothing is indicated as to whether a person understands what he hears or not. The construction with the accusative, however, describes a hearing which includes mental apprehension of the message spoken. So from this, it becomes evident that the two passages are not contradictory. Therefore, Acts 22:9 doesn't deny that Paul's companions heard certain sounds. It simply says that they didn't understand the sounds that they heard. Well, as I continue to pick apart my list, I was actually embarrassed with myself. Sure, there are a few inconsequential names and numbers in the Bible that must be considered copyist errors that arose over thousands of years. However, I was able to logically explain every alleged inconsistency of any real significance on my list. I mean, I hadn't even checked this stuff out. I called myself an intellectual skeptic, and yet I hadn't treated this matter with much credibility. Sadly, I had rejected the Bible by focusing on a little list of alleged contradictions, yet when presented with the miracle of the Bible's structure and survival and integration and historical veracity and archaeological evidence and scientific insights and outside corroborating records and hundreds of fulfilled prophecies, I stubbornly looked the other way. Well, now the double standard I was living started to reveal itself to me. You know, I actually stopped reading or even thinking for about a week. I mean, I had nowhere else to go. What was I going to do with all these new realities in my life? What was I going to do with those Old Testament prophecies of a coming Messiah? Well, that's the end of What Happened to Me, Part 4. For further resources, materials, and the footnotes to this section, go to www.allaboutthejourney.org, and please click on the podcast for Part 5 of What Happened to Me by Randall Niles.